everyone. I'm Mary O'Brien, an associate at Wilson Sonsini. Thank you for joining our Electronic Gaming Group podcast. I'm thrilled to have you join me as I interview several of my colleagues and subject matter experts to dig into key topics surrounding gaming companies. The points discussed today are not to be attributed to any particular company, including any employer of any speaker or to any client of Wilson Sonsini. This podcast is reflective of the industry as it was when we recorded in November of 2023. Recent litigation or new regulations may change the landscape of this industry in the future. The information in this podcast is for general information purposes only and may not reflect current law in your jurisdiction. Nothing in this podcast should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation, and this information is not intended to create, and receipt or listening does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. No listener of this episode should act or refrain from acting on the basis of any information included in or accessible through this episode without seeking legal or other professional advice from an appropriately licensed professional in the recipient state, country, or other appropriate jurisdiction. Today I have with me Scott Cohn, senior counsel in our regulatory practice, joining us from our New York office, and Georgia Rabbits, a partner in our regulatory practice, joining from our Washington, D.C. office. Thank you very much to the both of you for joining us today. Georgia, can you talk a little bit about your practice focusing on regulatory issues? And I would love to know how you first became interested in specializing in the regulatory space, and how has gaming industry been a part of your practice?
Well, hi, Mary. First of all, I want to thank you for inviting us to be part of this podcast. It's super exciting, and we are going to be talking about a subject that is very near and dear to our hearts, which is the concept of safety and electronic gaming. I'll tell you, in answer to your question, how I started practicing in this space, which is kind of a little bit of a niche space. It's kind of off the beaten path. I have been in the regulatory space for many, many years. I started out as an FDA lawyer. Oh my gosh, when I think about the number of years it's been, it's too long to count. But anyway, when I started, I was working with companies that were only regulated in terms of safety by the FDA. And what happened was, as their product offerings expanded, they wound up going into other regulated spaces. So, for instance, you know, always their advertising was regulated by the Federal Trade Commission. As they started to offer kind of new and exciting things in response to customer demand, they wound up meandering, so to speak, into the consumer product space. And as an attorney to these companies, I wound up following them into this space. So that's kind of how I wound up doing consumer product safety. Some of those companies then discovered electronic gaming. And as a result, my practice took me there as well with respect to the safety issues. And I have to say that I have watched this industry evolve over the last couple of decades. A lot of the safety issues have remained constant, which Scott and I are going to be addressing. Of course, as the technology becomes, you know, more novel, more sophisticated, you know, we're going to go into quite some depth about a lot of the issues remain the same, which is, you know, how to evaluate something. So it's always been really fun. It's a bit of a puzzle because you have to really look at something and understand how it's used. And that's what we've been doing all these years. So that's kind of how I fell into it.
Same question to you, Scott. I would love to know how you first became interested in specializing in the space and how it's shaped your legal career and how the gaming industry has been a part of that space as well.
Thank you, Mary, for having us here today. So in terms of my background, I was initially drawn to the regulatory space fresh out of law school. I was offered a position with a customs law firm that dealt with international trade. And the position was so intriguing to me because it seemed to touch upon so many different aspects of law within that one practice. You know, as a customs lawyer, your primary challenge is to help your clients successfully import through U.S. customs and get the goods here from overseas. But then invariably, your client turns to you and says, okay, now what? What else do I have to comply with now that my products are here? So you then have to help your client navigate the complex web of various federal and state laws that affect their products. And this is really with clients in industries ranging from apparel, footwear, toys, cosmetics, and of course, electronics and gaming. And you really just need to understand the bigger picture, the full federal regulatory scheme. It's really quite complex. But the one area that always stood out for me was product safety, because we all have varying opinions about government regulation and overreach, whether it's too burdensome for businesses, and we share those concerns. But when it comes to protecting our families and communities, I think we all, you know, generally agree that laws and regulations that are designed to promote safe products really serve everyone's best interests. I truly enjoy being able to share my decades of experience in the nuances of product safety and product safety regulation. And I believe that had an impact upon companies as they're in the process of designing and manufacturing cutting-edge products, and at the same time, incorporating safety as a top priority. And that's held true in a lot of our representation of electronic gaming companies when it deals with hardware, instruction manuals, warnings, and things of that sort to really keep the games fun and at the same time safe for the users.
Thank you, Scott. I think it's my first question really is to Georgia. It's a very high level question. Who regulates the safety of electronic gaming?
Mary, that's a great question and a really good one to start out with. The safety of electronic gaming is primarily regulated by the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission. A lot of people have not heard of this regulatory agency. It is a federal regulatory agency, but it's an independent one. It's much smaller than most of the other federal regulatory agencies, but its mandate is to enforce laws relating to the safety of consumer products. And the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission, also known as the CPSC, has jurisdiction over nearly every consumer product. And really, that's a phrase that's very, very important, because when you think about an electronic gaming product, will CPSC have jurisdiction over this product? You know, does it have the authority to regulate it? The first question is, well, would it be considered a consumer product? So we always have to revisit the definition of what a consumer product is to see if, in fact, it's something CPSC would regulate. The definition of a consumer product is incredibly broad. It's actually defined as any article or component part thereof produced or distributed for sale to a consumer for use in or around a household or residence, a school, in recreation or otherwise, or for the personal use, consumption, or enjoyment of a consumer in or around a household or residence or school. So you see how broad that is. Nearly everything we touch on any given day is a consumer product, and CPSC has jurisdiction over it. Electronic gaming, both hardware and software, certainly would fall within this definition. You know, CPSC, there have been many instances of recalls or statements by the commission involving gaming hardware and software. Basically, unless a product is exempted by the statute, and there are some exemptions, then it's going to be covered by the Consumer Product Safety Act, which is the primary statute that the commission administers. So just to give you an idea, like some of the exemptions are medical devices, boats, food, aircraft, motor vehicles, pesticide, tobacco, things of that nature. And even in those instances, there can still be certain aspects of products like that that are still going to be regulated by the commission. So they do have very, very broad jurisdiction. You know, you're probably wondering, so as an electronic gaming company, what are the responsibilities that a company would have under the Consumer Product Safety Act? In general, an electronic gaming product, both the hardware and the software, like all consumer products, should be safe for their intended use. And that seems like a really simplistic, straightforward concept. But in fact, it's a little bit more nuanced and complicated, because the notion of intended use can be less than entirely clear, which we're going to get into exactly what that means and why something might be perhaps not an intended use by the company, but in fact, once it's in consumers' hands, you know, they assume that this is the intended use of the product. Another important responsibility that electronic gaming companies have under the Consumer Product Safety Act is that they are responsible for something we call the foreseeable misuse, or use and abuse of a product. And this goes back to the intended use of a product. So typically a product will bear labeling that indicates how it's supposed to be used. And that's true as well for electronic gaming. It can be very clearly written, and you know, you would expect that consumers would certainly understand what the intended use of the product is. But lo and behold, once the product is on the market, the company learns that consumers are using it in a different manner. But the manner that they're using it was foreseeable. So even though it wasn't an explicit intended use, nonetheless, it was a foreseeable use or a misuse of the product. And companies can be responsible for that as well, and oftentimes are, depending on whether it was foreseeable or not. One of the things we advise electronic gaming companies of is they need to keep in mind this concept of best practices as they develop new products. And certainly, product design is critical. Safety must be paramount when designing products. And sometimes, you know, safety really depends on, you know, what's the age of the consumer that's going to be using the product. That goes to what they can, you know, understand in terms of the warnings or the limitations of the product. And sometimes developing proper design for a product, you need experts. They're known as human factors experts who can really understand how a game is likely to be used or misused. They can be very useful, and oftentimes we'll partner with a human factors expert to really understand how a consumer is likely to use a product. Because people will be touching hardware, oftentimes you have to do mechanical and chemical testing so you know what substances a consumer is going to be in contact with when they actually play a game. That's very, very important. That lists toxic substances. And so obviously you want to stay away from chemicals like that. And one of the most important responsibilities that an electronic gaming company has under the Consumer Product Safety Act is the obligation to know how your product is performing in the marketplace. And I don't mean from a commercial perspective, although that could be a part of it, but in terms of its safety profile. Are you receiving consumer complaints? Are consumers telling you that they got injured, their child got injured, they were using the product, the game, and as they were playing with it, there was a piece of the hardware that went flying and hit somebody or hit a sibling? This kind of monitoring is critical for electronic gaming companies because that's oftentimes how a company can determine, is there a problem that perhaps they did not identify, either foresee or specifically identify as they were developing the product, but now they're learning about it from the marketplace? We can't begin to tell you how critical it is to really know what is happening with that game once it's been launched.
So what would happen if something went wrong in the marketplace, Georgia?
Mary, that's another great question. Well, hopefully nothing will go wrong in the marketplace, but the reality is that sometimes it does. And when it does, a company must be prepared. But a significant part of being prepared is knowing what is required under the law as a product manufacturer, distributor, or retailer. What are their obligations if they're sitting on information of the nature that I just described a moment ago, where, you know, you have these consumers saying, wait a second, something was sharp, I got cut, my child got hurt, et cetera, et cetera. Well, when a company learns of information about something going wrong in the marketplace, a company has to determine first and foremost whether that information rises to the level of something that needs to be reported to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And there is an explicit statutory requirement regarding reporting. And lots of companies don't fully appreciate this obligation until perhaps it's a little too late. When it's too late, unfortunately, the commission can act in very punitive ways to send a message not only to that particular gaming company, but everybody else in the industry. So a company receives information that there could be a problem in the marketplace. Well, what it needs to do is evaluate that information. Oftentimes, that will involve either using your inside counsel and your outside counsel, perhaps an outside expert, company engineers, depending on what the nature of the problem is, to really determine whether the product is failing to comply with a particular consumer product safety rule that applies to that specific product to determine whether the product contains a defect, which means, you know, something's wrong with it, that could create a substantial product hazard or otherwise just create some kind of unreasonable risk of serious injury or death. The first instance that I mentioned, which is they have to report if a product fails to comply with an applicable consumer product safety rule, that's kind of black and white. Either it does or it doesn't. So if it turns out you learn that your product fails to comply, that's really easy. You need to report it, okay? The second two instances are much more nuanced, much more oblique, and we could probably spend many podcasts discussing. And these are the concepts of whether a product defect creates a substantial product hazard or an unreasonable risk of serious injury or death. If you listen closely, you'll see that there's a couple different prongs to those standards. In this one I mentioned a moment ago, which is that a product has to contain a defect, and then that defect has to create or could create a substantial product hazard or an unreasonable risk of serious injury or death. So first and foremost, a company has to determine, is the product defective in some way? The defect can manifest itself in a number of ways. There can be a manufacturing defect, even though, let's say, the game could have been so well designed, but there was a problem in the manufacturing process. Or guess what? It was manufactured fabulously, but the design of the product somehow didn't capture perhaps the foreseeable misuse. And as a result, it could be viewed as defective. Or the last way a product could be defective is it could have a labeling issue. Perhaps the labeling contained inaccurate information or omitted important safety information. And that aspect of the product could also give rise to a defect. And certainly in under any one of those scenarios, if people are getting hurt or they could get hurt, then it's not difficult to then arrive at a conclusion that that defect creates a substantial product hazard or an unreasonable risk of serious injury or death. Given how broad the concept of a substantial product hazard is, it's easier for at least the commission to take the position that a defect creates that. Now, a company also has an obligation to make a report to the commission if it's involved with product settlements or adjudications involving allegations of grievous injury or death within a two-year period. So that obligation exists as well. And one important thing that I would like to address about this concept of reporting is the way the statute and the regulations work is that companies don't have a lot of time to assess complaint information and to come to a decision as to whether information is reportable, because the section of the statute actually requires that companies report immediately to the commission once they receive reportable information. Now, I know that sounds a bit like a tautology, but immediately means within 24 hours. That's not a tremendous amount of time. Under the regulations, CPSC allows 5 days for information to reach an appropriate individual who has the requisite authority in the company to help make a reporting decision. So you do have those 5 days for information to flow up to the top. And then the regulations also permit a 10-day investigation period for a company to really look at the information it's received from the marketplace and come to a decision. But it has to be what we call a bona fide investigation. It can't be that in 10 days, the company really didn't do too much other than just kind of push paper around. It has to really be an active investigation. And the reason why this is so important is because the commission can levy penalties, both civil and criminal, and they have. I think the current civil penalty limit is perhaps over $17 million. That's a lot of money, although I guess in terms of compared to other agencies, perhaps it's not so much, but the problem is the brand damage that ensues. Consumers, many times they're going to be more reticent to purchase something, a particular kind of game, if in fact a company was assessed a civil penalty for failing to report safety information. It can be quite damaging if that happens. One final thought I'd like to leave you with about when things go wrong in the marketplace is that these standards are somewhat gray, except for when a product fails to meet a specific safety rule. The analysis is gray. What the commission is going to expect under what circumstances can be a little gray. And of course, the commission is the ultimate arbiter of whether the product is hazardous, defective, and whether a particular company reported within the appropriate time frame. A lot of this analysis that we do with companies, we're able to bring to bear our many years of experience working with companies and looking at particular sets of facts or similar sets of facts and helping them come to a decision as to perhaps what they should be doing with adverse information that's coming from the marketplace.
Thank you, Georgia. And to tie on that a little bit, I'd love to hear Scott's thoughts about what a substantial product hazard is.
Yes, Mary, thank you. That's a great question. And actually, that is usually the crux of the analysis when it comes to whether a company needs to report pattern of complaints coming in or social media posts or news reports about incidents that are happening with their product. You really have to delve into whether you meet the CPSC's definition of what a substantial product hazard is. And that ties into the defect, as you said. So just to sort of add to what Georgia was reviewing, it's interesting, the CPSC, Consumer Product Safety Commission, does not define the term defect specifically, but it does give some guidelines in its regulations as to what you should think about when you're determining whether or not a defect exists. I'll just sort of read you a couple of definitions excerpted from the regulation. So a defect can be a fault, a flaw, or an irregularity that causes weakness, failure, or inadequacy in form or function of the product. As Georgia mentioned before, it could be the result of manufacturing or production error, where the product is not in the form intended by its design, or the product fails to perform in accordance with its design, for example. The defect can be entirely have to do with the actual overall design of the product itself. And as Georgia mentioned, it could also be in the way it's marketed, in the instructions that are included if they're deficient in some way. They don't provide enough warning, let's say, on how to use something or how to be careful in using it. So all of those factors need to be looked at when you determine whether or not a product is truly defective or not. And to your question about substantial product hazard, that's the legal term that CPSC uses to describe whether or not a company might have to report an ongoing series of incidents, let's say, or complaints. So substantial product hazard is defined partially as a product defect, which because of the pattern of the defect, the number of defective products distributed in commerce, the severity of the risk, for example, all of those creates a substantial risk of injury to the public. So you have to have a defect, and then you have to have this substantial risk of injury to the public. So you may have a defect, but then in the end, it may turn out that it doesn't create a huge risk of injury to the public, which is actually very interesting. We've had cases where a product may, in fact, turn out to have a defect in its design or manufacturing, but then you look at the incidents and they don't really sort of cross that threshold into being a serious injury risk to the public. So you do have to look at those factors altogether. Just to delve in a little bit further into the factors that are looked at, in addition to what the CPSC put in its regulations, I mean, you need to really just look at the nature of the product. How is it used? What's the design? What is it made of? Are the materials sturdy? Are they robust? What kind of packaging is it in? What kind of warnings accompany or printed on the product? How many products are already in the marketplace? How severe are the injuries? What is the potential severity of the injuries? Even if no injuries have been reported or some minor injuries, if the injuries could be very severe under certain circumstances, that's a very important factor, even if it hasn't actually happened. And then the likelihood of injury based on the intended use, as Georgia had mentioned previously, or the reasonably or foreseeable use or misuse of the product. And then the size and the nature of the population group that's exposed to the product. So if it's a children's product, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny to the nature of those complaints and incidents. That's a very protected group, as it should be, in terms of population group being exposed. So it's really important to carefully evaluate complaints and incidents as they come in to determine whether you might have a defect. And again, using engineers, engineering companies or internal departments to analyze the product, test it, see if there is some deviation from specifications or some design defect very, very important as part of the analysis to reach a conclusion as to whether you might actually have to report this to the CPSC. As Georgia mentioned, in addition to a defect that creates a substantial risk of injury, you also have to report if, aside from any defect and notwithstanding whether or not there's a defect, if there is an unreasonable risk of serious injury or death, you need to report those incidents to the CPSC, even if you don't find a defect. And serious injury is defined as grievous bodily injury. We're talking extreme injuries, and CPSC has a complete list of what those injury types are. In terms of the unreasonableness of the risk of having those injuries, again, you need to look at the utility of the product, the level of exposure to consumers, the nature and the severity of the hazard, and so on. And again, this is just another aspect that has to be looked at when you start receiving complaints and incident report. There's a lot to consider, and consulting with counsel that's experienced in product safety matters is really essential, in our opinion, comes to companies that are receiving reports that are problematic and could lead to potential injury.
Thank you, Scott. Georgia, I would love to touch a little bit more about this reporting concept. Can you talk to me a little bit about voluntary reporting and what are the sources of reportable information?
Sure, I'm happy to. The CPSC relies heavily on companies engaging in what they call voluntary reporting of product safety issues. And when I say voluntary reporting, I mean that the company learns of something and determines that, yes, we need to share this information with the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and we're going to file a report and do that. The commission, every so often, will come to a company when it has learned of troubling safety information about a product. It will go to the company. But you can expect when that happens, it's always worse for the company. So we always encourage gaming companies and all of our clients that they need to be proactive. The way the statute and the regulations and the commission, how it all works, is they're really depending on companies to be responsible corporate citizens and review information in a timely fashion. And then, if necessary, voluntarily report that information to the commission. The reports are done via Section 15B of the Consumer Product Safety Act. And that's a system that really works very well, usually, assuming a company learns of the information that's problematic and is able to process it in a timely fashion. You know, information that a company learns about, the sources of reportable information, can get to a company any number of ways. So companies really need to have a pretty large net to capture that information so it can assess it properly. So for instance, gone are the days when consumers will buy a game or any other product, and if they're not happy, that they will only contact the company. Oh no. Many, many times, the first thing they'll do is turn to social media and see if there's other dissatisfaction or complaints of that nature, or they'll just post something themselves. So I would say that consumer incident reports via the social media route, probably one of the most popular and effective ways for a company to obtain information that could be potentially reportable. Obviously, actual lawsuits that have been filed, you know, product liability suits for any kind of property damage or personal injury or claims, threatened claims, that's another very important source of reportable information. Another one is you have lots of consumers all of a sudden returning products for the same reason. Typically, there's a sign there that if everybody's having a problem like that, it typically means that you have a pattern, and patterns can be quite suggestive of a defect of some sort. The commission also shares information letters with companies, because sometimes consumers will actually file something with the commission, alert the commission, put something on saferproducts.gov, and the commission will share that information with the particular gaming company and give the company an opportunity to review the information and determine whether the information is in fact reportable. Sometimes a company will learn of reportable information because it will be doing some periodic auditing of the product. And lo and behold, they just discovered that it fails a particular safety standard, or they've done something either with an outside lab or their internal engineering team. You'd be surprised. This actually does happen because, you know, as products are manufactured over time, sometimes components change, downstream vendors change. So you can have manufacturing issues, and it's not uncommon at all. So those are typically are the best sources of reportable information.
And what about when you have to file the Section 15 report you mentioned earlier?
So as I noted, you don't have a tremendous amount of time to do that. Once you have obtained reportable information, you have 24 hours of receiving that information and to turn around and at least make initial contact with the commission to let them know that you have reportable information. Of course, sometimes the way information flows at a particular company, the people who will learn about reportable information first may not have the requisite authority to make a decision as to whether something should be filed. They don't have the decision-making authority to bind the company. So under the statute and the regs, the commission does allow for 5 days for that information to flow, to bubble up to the top of the company and make a report if necessary. And then, of course, you know, you have the possibility of a longer investigation period if it's necessary. If you're really investigating it and due to, like, let's say, the complexity of a particular circumstance, and you'd be surprised, this analysis can be quite complex. And I can remember working on a particular defect investigation using an outside laboratory, working, you know, hand in glove with the company. And I think we worked on it for a year. That's how difficult it was. So, and I'm not suggesting that any company take that amount of time, but what I'm saying is that certainly there are times when a longer investigation period is appropriate, and the commission, if it's bona fide, will recognize it that way as well.
And what happens if you don't timely file a report?
Well, that is a problem. If you do not meet the timing requirements, CPSC will, in all likelihood, open an investigation. So let's say you don't file it within either the 24 hours or the 5 day plus the 24 hours or the 10 day investigation period, but you ultimately do file it. Once you make your initial report with the commission and then you make what we call the full report, one of the questions that the commission spends a lot of time reviewing in a company's report is something that goes like this: when did the company first learn of this information? And I would say that the commission spends a tremendous amount of time looking at those responses. And reports are filed under the penalty of perjury. So companies must and should, and, you know, all the companies that we've worked with, they take them very, very seriously because the penalties are quite steep if you file a false report. So when you're answering that question, when did you first learn of this information, that will help the commission determine whether your report was timely or not. A failure to report in a timely fashion is considered an actual violation of the Consumer Product Safety Act. And actually, what happens is if the commission does think that you failed, the company failed to file in a timely fashion, it will let the company know that and give the company an opportunity to explain why the commission should not levy some kind of civil penalty on the company. But it's difficult to successfully persuade the commission that kind of past these time frame or significantly past them, that in fact you did not violate the timing provisions of the statute. It's a little bit of an uphill battle. And if you take a look at most of the civil penalties that the commission has levied over the years, it really has to do with a failure to report in a timely fashion, which is a failure to report. And I guess the commission, you know, and it's certainly understandable because from the commission's perspective, the reason why there are such strict reporting timeframes is because if the company knows about information relating to the potential lack of safety of its game or its product, that means the product is going to be out in the marketplace that much longer, which means that more consumers can get injured. So that's why they take it so seriously. And, you know, as attorneys who counsel companies in this space, and that's one of the things we always stress, everything you do has to be with consumer safety in mind, because when the retrospective is done by the government, that's where the focus is going to be.
And so how do you go about making a report under Section 15B?
It happens in two stages. One is via an initial report, and that initial report is then followed by a full report. And just like it sounds, an initial report is a relatively pithy filing that a company does as soon as it learns about reportable information, and basically just is a way for the company to share the information that it knows, you know, the name of the product, the description of the product, the name of the company, the address of the company, the retailer, and perhaps what the nature of the defect or noncompliance is. A company doesn't really need to say anything more than that. But what's important about that initial report is that it stops the reporting clock. Until that report is filed, that initial report, every hour, every day is counted in terms of how long it took the company from when it received reportable information to the date it actually made its first report to the commission. So what's significant is it stops that reporting clock. And sometimes, even when a company, you know, a gaming company and other kinds of consumer product company, sometimes even if they're not sure whether it's reportable or not, it might be a good idea to nonetheless file the initial report. So at least you've stopped that reporting clock and you let the commission know that you're looking at this matter closely, but you want them to know about it. And they always appreciate that. It's certainly speaks to the level of a company's good corporate citizenship and due diligence and how conscientious they are. It can really work to a company's advantage. After the initial report is filed with the commission, a company will hear back from somebody in the compliance group at CPSC, typically along with somebody from the general counsel's office, and they will request that a full report, a full Section 15B report, be submitted to the commission. And they give typically about 2 weeks or so, maybe 3 weeks. And sometimes, if necessary, you can get an extension, because once you file that report, a company usually puts their product on what we call a stop sale anyway. So the product is no longer being actively distributed in the marketplace. And obviously, you wouldn't want to, because if you suspect there's a problem with the product, it would be really not reflect well on the company if it continues to distribute the product. The full report is very detailed, lots of questions about who, what, when, where. These are very important questions because the commission studies the answers. You know, when did a company learn about it? Another very sensitive issue, which is companies spend a lot of time preparing, is not only the nature of the problem, but how many incidents there are. How many consumer complaints did the company receive? And sometimes it can be difficult to know whether a particular complaint that you received should be grouped in with other complaints. There's a whole science to consumer complaints, because when there are clear patterns to a product complaint, that's easy. But sometimes there aren't. Typically, what a company is reporting in terms of the number of incidents it's received, you know, safety incidents, becomes the basis for the press release. So companies want to be very careful in terms of the information they share, because they want it to be accurate. So if, for instance, a company receives, let's say, 20 complaints, but only really 10 of them have to do with the product safety issue at hand, and the other 10 have to do with something related only to color fastness. I'm just making this up, and are not really related to the safety issue. Well, it would be misleading to include them in the full report. So a lot of thought is given to numbers and to obviously when a company learned of information, and then also what kind of corrective action they think is necessary. Once you have a product in the marketplace, it's not kind of one size fits all. Sometimes a company wants to obviously get the product back as quickly as possible from the marketplace. And sometimes it's an easy fix. You can just send consumer something and they can take care of it. Or you can fix the labeling and you don't necessarily have to retrieve the product or have consumers dispose of the product, particularly when you're talking about high price point items. If it's an easy fix and you don't have to actually have the product returned and get a full refund, sometimes that can work out quite well and can be acceptable to the commission.
And what would be some examples of these recalls playing out in real time? Have any gaming companies been impacted by issues with their hardware or software?
Yes. And actually, let me turn that over to Scott because he has some fabulous examples of that.
Yeah, hardware is really the primary focus when it comes to CPSC. And it could be the actual console itself, for example, with charging, accessories, AC adapters, things of that sort. I'll give you just a few examples. So in 2017, Xbox One had a recall for a battery charger that was an accessory for the handheld devices. What was happening was the battery chargers were overheating, and obviously that can create not only a fire hazard, but can also create a hazard for the user if they happen to come into contact with it, touching it, or brushing up against it, or whatever might happen. So that was a pretty large recall. Just another recall that comes to mind is a gaming headset that was found to have mold growing on the inside of the earpieces. And that was interesting because the hazard there is exposure to that mold for certain populations that might be immune sensitive or immunocompromised. But just in general, you don't want to really have mold on the face or anywhere near your ears or nose or whatever the case might be. It was Turtle Beach, I believe, that was the company that did the recall of those gaming headsets. And I think there have been a couple of other recalls of mold forming on certain peripherals that were either worn or handled frequently. Of course, the AC adapter recalls, they were very prevalent many years ago. We haven't seen too many recently, at least in the gaming world. They do continue in the laptop world as far as lithium batteries and so on. But there were AC adapters that overheated in connection with Sony PlayStation. And that was a very large recall. So yeah, those are examples of hardware items, but they're also items that are considered sort of ancillary to the game. And that would be, let's say, you know, figurines that aren't really used in the game, but they're sold along with the game. So if they're toy-like or novelty items, there have been recalls of those types of products for containing excess lead, for example, in surface coatings or paint. So there's a wide variety of recalls that have affected the gaming industry.
So Scott, with all of the emerging technologies that are happening in the gaming industry right now, how has this impacted the regulation of consumer safety?
Well, I think regulation is certainly trailing the technology, so it has quite a bit to catch up. However, current regulation does capture whatever technology is in existence now. So CPSC will find a way typically to bring in anything that's creating a hazard, even if it hasn't been addressed by a specific regulation or updated regulation. It generally will be brought back into existing regulations if it has a defect of some sort or if it creates a substantial product hazard or an unreasonable risk of serious injury. Along those lines, with wearables now hitting the market, that is a big area that I think CPSC will be looking into. Actually, CPSC does have a definition of wearables because they are trying to keep pace with everything, and they define it as devices or objects that are connected to the body, either by direct contact with the skin or otherwise attached outside of clothing. So we're talking about everything from headsets that interact with gaming consoles to provide 3D gaming, mechanical exoskeletons that can be used to augment muscle power, wearable sensors that track physiological functioning. And by the way, a lot of those sensors also could cross into FDA regulation if they happen to address, you know, monitoring certain health metrics. So there could be dual regulation by CPSC and FDA if there is some medical type or health related function of it. Also along the lines of emerging technologies, there are new materials, nanomaterials, there's robotics, as I mentioned, and really coming down the pike is obviously implantable technologies and brain machine interface technology. So there's quite a bit coming through. But again, until they're addressed by specific regulations, they will still be subject to CPSC enforcement if they're defective. Some of the issues we anticipate are with any new technologies that, let's say, there's a loss of a safety function. You know, new technologies, you know, not really tested in the real world for any length of time, safety devices on the product may fail. So those are the kinds of things, fires and burns, obviously, as technology draws more power, portable power, things of that sort. You may end up with overheating and more burn issues and fires and combustible issues, as we've seen with lithium battery technology. Wonderful technology, amazing. but unfortunately, it's still causing some explosions and things of that sort. So shock issues, of course, chemical exposure with new materials that are untested and sort of new alloys and new combinations of materials and even textiles that are used could create irritation or create a toxic situation. Also, because mechanical risks can be amplified in a lot of these new technologies, so you can end up with more lacerations or contusions or other traumas if it transports a user more quickly than normal. For example, in moving or sort of motion activated games, it could pose an increased risk of falls or even more severe impact. So there's a lot to think about with new technologies, you know, just some of the special hazards associated with wearables. I think we mentioned that skin irritations, muscle strain, chemical or thermal burns, hearing damage, in fact, from some of the audio devices that are used. There are quite a lot of issues to possibly consider. Just want to add at the end here, in addition to the Consumer Product Safety Commission, as Georgia had mentioned up front, there are state agencies, for example, California and Proposition 65, that regulate products that may contain, for example, BPA or PFAS, that's the new forever chemical, lead, phthalates, cadmium, heavy metals, things of that sort have to be warned against, to have warning labels on products if you have a certain level of those chemicals, or in some cases, if you have those chemicals at all. You have to have warning labels for California. Other states restrict the use of certain chemicals and materials, and this can affect hardware items. And even if they're not in contact with the consumer very frequently, like a console, for example, if it contains lead, it's possible that it could, on the outer surface, and it could expose a consumer, it could be subject to state restrictions. So there's a lot to sort of consider in the realm of product safety beyond the Consumer Product Safety Commission on the state level. I think that sort of gives you an idea of emerging technologies and some of the issues that should be considered.
No, thank you, Scott. This has been wonderful. And I was really hoping, Georgia, would you mind leaving us as a closing thought, the biggest piece of advice that you can give to gaming companies that are navigating through these potential consumer product safety issues and what you want them to take away from what we've talked about today?
I would say they should take away two concepts. One concept is foreseeable use / misuse. And that's something that they should be thinking of as they design their product. It goes back to the issue of how they intend it should be used and how a consumer could perceive that the product can be used. They must control for that foreseeable use / misuse. That's one high-level thought that I would certainly recommend they think about. Second one is, once that product is launched in the marketplace, monitor closely what consumers are saying about it. And if they are getting any feedback that questions or should make them question whether the product perhaps is posing some safety issues, don't just sweep that under the rug. Evaluate it promptly with counsel who know this space, with folks inside the company. Make sure everything stays privileged and make sure you do things in a timely fashion. So this way, your company does not find itself the subject of a civil penalty and perhaps dealing with the fallout of brand damage relating to something like that. So just those two thoughts, Mary.
Thank you, Georgia. And thank you both for your time today. Wilson Sonsini advises a wide variety of clients in the gaming industry. If you'd like more information about the legal issues arising in the gaming space, please check out the Electronic Gaming Group's website or our newsletter, The Scramble. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to any member of our Electronic Gaming Group. Thanks for tuning in, everyone.